Now at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Play it loud. Instruments of Rock and Roll. Tracking rock's seismic influence and the celebrated instruments that created its defining voice. Played by the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix, Joan Jett, the Rolling Stones, and other legendary musicians. Every weekend, the Met is open late Friday and Saturday. Tour the galleries, then enjoy drinks on the Cantor Roof Garden, where sculpture meets the skyline. There's always something new to experience at the Met. Preview Play It Loud at MetMuseum.org.
With a World Elite MasterCard, it's easier for you to be spontaneous with the new built-in benefits for Lyft, Fandango, Postmates, and more. These automatic benefits allow you to save more. Whether you're looking for a ride to a show, to surprise a loved one with dinner, or you just want to catch a movie on a whim, World Elite MasterCard has got you covered. Learn more about these exciting benefits at MasterCard.com/WorldElite. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your the bicentennial ain't much to celebrate anyhow of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. I would say that we've been on hiatus. It's not quite accurate because we're going to be coming hard and heavy in the coming weeks to compensate for the gap that we have left you with. Chantal, I heard you. FYI. You were just listening to some Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan is a famous American musician that I did not know a lot about. I've realized that there is a certain subset of podcast. And that subset of podcast is John Perelis Explains Things to Me. John Perelis is the chief pop music critic of the New York Times and has been around for every important innovation in popular music for more decades than I've been alive. JP's here.
I wasn't there for the Edison cylinder, though, I gotta say.
Okay, but as far as I'm concerned, the Edison cylinder did not slap, so it's fine. It's not a problem. In preparation for this, I kind of went on some of the Dylan fan sites that, like, sort of meticulously detail.
Good for you.
Right. Well, no, not really. So these fan sites are fascinating because they'll be like, Bob Dylan has a songwriting credit on an album by some like white singer-songwriter I've never heard of that's coming out only in Austria. Long review to follow next week. There's a very like the obsessive Dylanologists are still here and they're still at it.
Oh, more than ever.
They have a bounty because the Rolling Thunder Review box set of the 1975 tour, 1975 is not the bicentennial, which is weird that the film opens with some bicentennial references. Anyway, sidebar, that box set is out by the time this podcast is out. And then there is a film directed by Martin Scorsese that is sort of quasi-documentary about this tour. That's all happening. And this is a bounty of unseen and unheard footage, correct?
Mostly, yeah.
Mostly. As you pointed out in your excellent piece, and by the way, that piece was a banger.
Thank you.
Seriously, a real banger, and made me almost want to listen to the entirety of this box set. But I'm not going to. But conceptually, it made me almost want to listen to that box set. As you point out, a lot of the material, that sort of the best material, had been culled for a previous release of one of the bootleg series releases.
Yeah, but usually with these bootleg series, they do the monster dump. And then they do a highlights. The highlights to this one came out in 2002.
Right. But there are still...
Complete is complete. 14, you don't have to get both.
14 discs. This is like a low B zip file drop of music is what this is. I've seen the film. I have not listened to the box set. But I have some questions about Bob Dylan in this particular time. One of the things that I learned from watching the movie is that from 66 to 74, he didn't tour.
Correct.
Or in between 66 and 74, he didn't tour. What was happening with Dylan during that time frame that set us up for what we see here?
Oh, boy. Well, the 66 tour was the Going Electric, Getting Booed Nightly tour, playing the best he ever played. Columbia dumped all of those, and that's the box set you should listen to, because he's on fire every night.
And what did Dylan represent at that time? And because obviously him going electric was him trying to shuck off some of the, I assume, some of the cultural and spiritual politics of the folk revival. But what did he represent in that moment before he kind of went off grid or went off the live grid?
It was being an apostate to the folk revival and not being pure and acoustic and pretend uncommercial and writing earnest topical songs. I mean, Dylan started writing visionary songs instead that changed everything, instead of being one more contributor to Broadside Magazine.
Sick bird.
No, Broadside Magazine.
I don't even know what Broadside Magazine is, but I know that that's a bar. All my Broadside Magazine stands out here. It's no run for you today. It's no run. We've gone electric. We're not looking back.
He's an artist. He don't look back. He got quiet. He did John Wesley Harding, an album of sparse little songs. He went to Nashville and did Nashville Skyline and stopped smoking and sang Lay Lady Lay in a voice that he could never deploy again. He had the motorcycle accident that made him be reclusive with the band in Woodstock, inventing the band as its own sort of mystical Americana. He did Self-Portrait, an album that is an abomination. not my favorite album. It does have a couple of good songs on it that they rescued by taking the strings off. He was going through more changes more rapidly. I mean, this is before Lady Gaga. This is before David Bowie.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Dylan was the chameleon. This is before Madonna.
And it's interesting that you say that, because I've been thinking a lot separately from this about how ossified our current crop of pop stars are, even in a climate that would afford them endless opportunities for reinvention and reimagining themselves. And Kanye is his own beast, obviously, but you never see like a Jay-Z like basically remaking himself every two albums or every album, people operating at that level. That's just not a thing that happens. But Dylan was a person who clearly was willing to dismantle himself.
He had a head full of ideas that were driving him insane.
Also, he said something in the film that I thought was striking, where he was basically like, all these people trying to find themselves, you don't find yourself, you create yourself. True story.
Yes.
True story. Take that to heart. Tat it on your chest. Okay. Just a little note for the listeners. Keep that in mind.
He just had idea after idea after idea, change after change after change. I mean, after Self-Portrait, there's New Morning, which is kind of a semi-gospel album, and then I mean, he had a new person to be every 6 months or so.
Was he being received well with each of those changes, or was it dynamic and kind of evolving? And
it was changing? Up and down. I mean, Self-Portrait, Greil Marcus.
What up, Greil?
Greil Marcus did not like Self-Portrait, let's put it that way.
Okay.
I forget what the exact quote is, but it was something like, what is this crap?
All right, brought out the AR.
Yeah, but then New Morning was sort of back up, and then but Blood on the Tracks, everybody pretty much knew Blood on the Tracks was a good album. Before Blood on the Tracks, of course, was the reunion with the band to make Planet Waves and to tour arenas in 74 and make a whole bunch of money and reap the rewards of what he'd actually done in 65 and 66.
Right. And so that's the setup ultimately for the music and the film that we're coming to, which is actually just the year before. There is this kind of like epic arena tour.
Right. Superstar tour,
yeah.
Which, according to the liner notes, Dylan was not happy with, was a chore.
To do the tour,
yeah.
It says in the liner notes. It was a chore.
I mean, he had just made an album with the band and he didn't play any of the songs.
Yeah.
So he had done the arena tour. He was a superstar. He was a big draw. People were thinking, I'd better go see Bob Dylan now. He might not tour again.
Right.
So then he starts hanging out in Greenwich Village, and he's going to the other end, formerly the Bitter End, later to be the Bitter End.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to Gertie's Folk City, where he's getting back down to small scale, but he's also retracing his steps from like 1962, 1963, when he was an earnest folky singing topical songs and updating old blues songs.
Right.
And hanging with Joan Baez, his ex-romance, but got this idea for this roving hootenanny, which also seems, on the evidence of the film, to have been this psychological experiment of what happens when you put 70 people in three buses.
Right.
Mahjong halls.
Right. And so a thing that was clear to me, and we'll get deeper into the film a little bit later, but a thing that was clear to me in the film that I think I could understand now why it would have been obscure to me as a person who's not following, you know, not paying close attention to Bob Dylan, intensely charismatic, right?
Yeah.
And I can understand why all these people were like, yes, I will get on this bandwagon. You know, I will just, what do they say? It's a Commedia dell'arte tour. You know, like, right. I'll just get on the road and just see what whatever happens, happens. I can understand. And these are all people who are famous in their own right. It's not like it was him and a bunch of no-names. I mean, these are people who could have reasonably been doing their own tours.
Indeed. Dylan has that famous quote, she's an artist, she don't look back. And that has been his watchword for most of his career. But this was looking back. This was, I'm going to get together again with Joan Baez. I'm going to bring Allen Ginsberg on the bus. You know, I'm going to look back to Past Generation.
What do you think he was hoping to do by doing that? Was it to cleanse himself?
Don't ask me what Bob Dylan's intentions
are. Well, sure. Okay. Bob, if you're listening, feel free to email us at podcast@nytimes.com and you could tell me what your intentions were.
I think he's gone throughout his career by impulse. And a lot of those impulses have been brilliant. He had also, though, he had hooked up before Rolling Thunder with Jacques Levy, who was the director of O Calcutta and the co-author of Chestnut Mare, Bird's Hit, a guy who could tell a story really concisely. Through the years, there's a list of collaborators, but Dylan is not basically a collaborator. And most of the songs on Desire, which they had recorded before this tour, were written with Jacques Levy, and they're these wacky stories. I'm going to go up into the giant glacier and see if I can find this dead body that's going to make my fortune, kind of weird epic stories. That's Isis, which they played every night on the tour.
Should we listen to Isis?
Sure. Let's listen to Isis.
But I could not hold on to her very long. So I cut off my hair and I rode straight away for the wild unknown country where I could not go wrong. I came to a high place of darkness and light. The dividing line ran through the center of town. I hitched up my pony to a post on the right. Went into a laundry and washed my clothes down. A man in the corner approached me for a match. I knew right away he was not ordinary. He said, are you looking for something easy to catch? I said, I got no money, man. He said, that ain't necessary.
The thing about this box set is, I mean, let's get some of the, like, nuts and bolts out.
Yeah.
They recorded 5 concerts professionally.
This is all 1975. This is just after my birth. I was born, and then the Rolling Thunder review was recorded. I don't think so. I think these are all probably tribute songs to my birth. Probably, I would assume.
But anyway, so there.
Yes, indeed. Anyway,
returning to some semblance of reality.
Yeah,
there are 5 shows. There's a set list. It repeats mostly. There's something different. There's some wild cards, but you're getting a lot of renditions of Isis and One More Cup of Coffee and Romance in Durango. You're getting a lot of iterations. You actually, if you're a music total Dylan nerd, you are hearing this band get tighter and tighter and wilder and more playful, and you're hearing Dylan rev up. I mean, the thing about this is sort of a tangents of my mind. The thing about this is that
that's what we're here for.
They were playing small rooms, but Dylan is really like shouting through these songs. This is not Springsteen on Broadway. Dylan is projecting these songs. Dylan is belting these songs.
And let's talk a little bit about the rooms, because again, he was coming off an arena tour. This is not that. You mentioned before a Mahjong parlor. He's playing on a Native American reservation. He's playing at
a prison,
Clinton Correctional Facility.
But he's also playing at little town halls in like Falmouth.
Civic centers.
Yeah.
There's like a scene in the movie where he's in Plymouth. I think it must have been the tour opener. And some kid is like, why is he here?
Which
fair.
Yeah, fair. Definitely the right question.
Yeah.
Put that kid in journalism school.
Yeah.
So it was little places. I mean, they did get bigger. I mean, they did end up Madison Square Garden. along the way, they're playing these like tiny little halls. I mean, Dylan actually did a similar, what they call now, secondary markets tour when he was reviving himself in the 80s, because he was playing for people who, like, Bob Dylan's in town, I better go see him.
So you think that's a financial decision?
I think it's let's do something I haven't done decision.
Yeah.
The Rolling Thunder tour was definitely not a financial decision.
No, and the promoter guy in the film makes that clear.
The promoter guy in the film is Jim Giannopoulos. Looks like a promoter, doesn't he?
Oh, is he fictional?
He's the CEO of Paramount Pictures.
No. Really? Oh, my gosh. So he was not the promoter.
He was not the promoter.
Oh, my God.
I mean, that's the thing about the Scorsese film. Some of the key figures who you are shown documentation of and back in the day, and you hear their voices talking to Dylan, they do not exist.
Okay. I guess should we just dive into that? Because that's just such a heavy sigh for me. Should we just dive into it? So
sure.
I did not know, me not knowing much about Bob Dylan, I did not know that. I knew that there were fictional characters because of your piece.
Sorry, spoiler alert.
No, that's fine. I didn't know who they were. I kind of figured out throughout the course of the thing who they might be. So this film, it's just called Rolling Thunder Review, right?
No, it's called Rolling Thunder Review, A Bob Dylan Story. Note the use of article and
yes.
The use of story.
True.
A Bob Dylan Story.
So this film is directed by Martin Scorsese. It is built upon footage that was filmed on this tour for a different project.
Dylan had a 15-person film crew on this tour along with...
Very cash. Very cash.
But along with Beat Poets and Joni Mitchell and, you know, whoever.
All you rappers that think just because your man got like a DLR camera or a Red camera or whatever, that all of a sudden that you innovated having people document you constantly. No, Bob Dylan was out here in 1975 with a 15-person crew. Making metafiction and autofiction.
And he was also bringing people on stage, you know, for one night, just like a hip-hop tour.
There you go. So there, I'm not trying to hear, save it for elevator, you know?
So there was a film crew traveling with them. The footage from that tour, I don't think they used all of it, but there was the four-hour movie Rinaldo and Clara.
And that was a commercially released film, like in theaters?
Yeah.
Okay.
Independent release, came out in 78, so they had some time to work on it. Dylan plays a character called Rinaldo, who happens to be singing on stage with the Rolling Thunder Review. Ronnie Hawkins, who was the Canadian rockabilly from whom Dylan stole the band, formerly the Hawks. Ronnie Hawkins is billed as, quote, Bob Dylan. Dylan's Rinaldo, his wife Sarah is Clara. Joan Baez is the woman in white. If you look at the credits of the Scorsese film, which I'm sure after 2.5 hours you were...
I actually did stay.
But each person is assigned a
yes,
role.
Yes, the boxer, like Hurricane. Is the boxer, right. Like everybody's the something.
So that
it's like they're like Friends episodes. They all have the thes.
I think that's a Rinaldo homage.
I see. Was that film any good? Sounds bad.
People hated it.
Like Grill might have been like, what is this?
Okay, he's in whiteface, as he is throughout most
yes.
of this tour. He's playing a character, but they're filming this very real-life reality TV bus caravan across the Northeast.
That's what I'm saying.
I mean, there's a lot of meta going on.
This is 20 years before Boone & Murray Productions is out here with the real world. Bob Dylan was inventing meta-reality. Like, come on.
But it's meta. I mean, he's playing the songwriter who actually is the songwriter who's playing for real audiences in real rooms, but also thinking all of these meta transgressions.
But it still sounds bad.
The contemporary accounts say it was rambling.
Yeah, so probably not worth Friday Night Netflix.
Apparently there are rights problems with it. The only way to see it is as a bootleg.
Which is the raison d'etre for the whole thing? Is it that the tour exists to create the movie? Is it that the movie exists because the tour exists? Do you think that one came before the others?
You have to really do some planning to bring a 15-person film crew.
Yeah, so. Right, exactly.
So I suspect it was to make the movie, but I also think he wanted to do something he hadn't done.
Right.
You know, arenas weren't working for him, so maybe the town hall would. Linear logic maybe doesn't apply here. Maybe it's like, I want to go out on the road. Oh, why don't I bring a film crew? Oh, why don't I make it like a traveling carnival? According to the liner notes for the box set, which are really good, he was actually hoping that the Rolling Thunder review would be like a franchise that could continue without him. Let's just have this caravan of musicians like changing parts.
Like Warped Tour.
So he invented the Warped Tour.
Yeah, he invented the Warped Tour. It's amazing.
There was no moshing, though, that I could tell.
What is the music that is played as captured on the box set tell you about where Dylan was, and how does it compare? I assume there's recordings of that arena tour the previous year.
Yeah. Yeah.
What? How is it different from that? This feel, my guess, a lot more ramshackle, a lot more joyful, maybe?
Good guess. The band, I love the band. The band on stage was very meticulous. They would play like they played on their records, with maybe a few more solos. This thing is loose.
Yeah.
I mean, there are arrangements, as you can tell when you hear five versions of Isis. But you can see the tempos change. Dylan picks up a harmonica before the first verse one night. It's loose. They're definitely responding to him.
Yeah.
His whims.
And who are some of the players in the band that stood out to you in listening to this stuff?
Well, he had an interesting lead guitarist. He had a lead guitarist who did not come from the folk revival. Mick Ronson.
Mick Ronson. And he looks very different. And you watch the movie.
Yeah.
His hair is different. The way that his shirt is open down to the navel is very different.
Yeah, what is this guy doing here?
Yeah.
Except he's playing great lead guitar.
Great. Killing it.
Lurking in the background, very tall with sunglasses, is T-Bone Burnett, who with Stephen Soles and David Mansfield would form the Alpha Band and push Dylan toward evangelical Christianity in the years to follow. There's Joan Baez in the finale, which is a Woody Guthrie song straight out of Greenwich Village. Allen Ginsberg is playing finger cymbals. Joan Baez is singing. Ronnie Blakely is singing backup vocals. And the linchpin, the absolute center of musical attention besides Dylan, is Scarlett Rivera, the violinist. Scarlett Rivera is the one who makes Desire sound like Desire, the album. She is playing in the Desire songs almost constantly. I mean, Dylan is singing and she's sort of snake charming all around him. You can hear her getting bolder and bolder each night. And she's pretty bold to start with. There's a version on the album of Hurricane without the violin. And then all the others have her and it's just transformed. She's the anima to his storyteller.
And in the video footage, like, she's standing right next to him. Like, it seems like they're in literal dialogue.
Yeah, constantly.
Yeah, that more so than with any of the other band members, even Ronson.
I mean, she's challenging him and taunting him musically from the beginning. But by the time they play the last of the five shows they recorded, she's just really kicking it.
What's a good Scarlett document on this box?
One More Cup of Coffee. She takes him down into the depths of the underground.
Damn.
Smooth on the pillow where you lie. But I don't sense affection, no gratitude or love. Your loyalty is not to me, but to the stars above. One more cup of coffee for the road. One more. Before I go through the valley below, your daddy, he's an outlaw and a wanderer by trade. He'll teach you how to pick and choose, and how to throw the blade. He oversees his kingdom, so no stranger does it true. His voice, it trembles as he calls out for another plate of food.
Now at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Play It Loud, Instruments of Rock and Roll. Tracking rock's seismic influence and the celebrated instruments that created its defining voice. Played by the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix, Joan Jett, the Rolling Stones, and other legendary musicians. Every weekend, the Met is open late Friday and Saturday. Tour the galleries, then enjoy drinks on the Cantor Roof Garden, where sculpture meets the skyline. There's always something new to experience at the Met. Preview Play It Loud at MetMuseum.org.
With the World Elite MasterCard, it's easier for you to be spontaneous with the new built-in benefits for Lyft, Fandango, Postmates, and more. These automatic benefits allow you to save more. Whether you're looking for a ride to a show, to surprise a loved one with dinner, or you just want to catch a movie on a whim, World Elite MasterCard has got you covered. Learn more about these exciting benefits at MasterCard.com/WorldElite. Terms and restrictions apply.
Okay, let's pivot to this film.
Okay. But it's a Scorsese film, first of all, so it's got, like, crazy momentum.
Yeah, but, okay. This whole, like, we're going to invent a false narrative and, like, we're going to invent characters and I don't know. I didn't find it funny. I didn't find it. It feels very like pre-reality television to me, or pre kind of like people playing with the self in real life. My, you know, like my online self versus my true self, my film self versus my real self. Yeah, it's
which is your podcast self?
That's
we'll never know.
That's a dark question, to be totally honest with you. That's something I think about a lot. I might have to devote a whole episode to down the line. If you know me well, email me at podcast@nytimes.com and tell me, do you recognize me when you listen on podcast? Like, is this the person you know? I'm just curious. Just like drop me a note or send me a text message or DM or whatever. Like, just, and is the John you know in real life the same as the John you hear on podcast?
Personally, I've never been sure.
Yeah, that's fair. That is the first. Okay, so the first vote is in. It's a no.
but anyway,
so kind of like mockumentary style, like all this stuff obviously has been, it's a robust part of how pop culture is consumed, produced and consumed now. It feels a little like after this, these gestures feel a little like after the fact, daylight, dollar short to me. What did you think about them?
I would have preferred an actual documentary.
Yeah, that's all I could think.
I mean, what makes this so good is the stuff they shot in 1975.
Yeah, I mean, the live footage in this is phenomenal. Yeah. The backstage stuff is really good.
Yeah.
Him being a weirdo is super good.
Absolutely. All that stuff's good. That stuff is precious.
Why do you think they made this choice? Why did Scorsese? Marty, if you're listening.
Well, maybe he can write in.
Yeah, Marty, podcast@nytimes.com. Please drop me a line.
I'm not inside the mind of Martin Scorsese any more than I'm inside the mind of Bob Dylan.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe there was an intellectual justification, which is that since Dylan was playing Ronaldo, but being Dylan, that they thought they would throw in some more
so
wacky
characters. Rather than like kind of denature that footage and basically turn it into something not mundane, but straightforward, like a concert documentary or a tour documentary, they decided to like kind of like hyperspeed it and kind of like meta on top of the meta.
The filmmaker character, he
so that guy's
like,
fake. Spoiler.
Spoiler, sorry.
What's his name? Jorp Van Boot?
Van Dorp.
Van Dorp. Jorp Van Dorp.
I mean, he would be a good character. He'd be a good character in a comedy.
Good hair. Yeah, that guy had really good hair.
The other thing is, you know, they get Dylan, like recent, you know, old Dylan, to talk about him as if he was there.
That's
cheating.
So because I knew that there were some fictional things in the film, my sensors were really on. And the things that really set me off were actually not the interview with the fake filmmaker. It's that Dylan can't keep a straight face, even though his face is like a very obscure thing. You could tell when he's lying. I felt like in the moments where he's talking about the filmmaker, you can see he's sort of like, I'm going to get away with this. You know what I mean? Like, I could tell that he felt, like, mischievous.
Yeah.
And that was interesting to see, because it's not, I understand that might have been how Dylan was back in the day, but it's not how I have, you know, absorbed him in recent years.
But the thing is, that character's there to point out the psychological experiment aspect, which maybe no one else would say.
You mean the original psychological aspect? Right, but it also could have just stood on its own.
Yeah, well, recut it, you know?
Yeah, release the raw files.
Oh, no.
Release the raw files.
But, I mean, but you know, there must be thousands or at least hundreds of hours of film from there. I mean,
is Ratso Sloman a real person?
Yes, Larry Sloman. Yes, is a real person.
Yes, was he? He was really writing for Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
So that scene where he's interviewing the girl who had had the conversation with Dylan about mental marriage.
Maybe it was for Ronaldo and Clara.
That did have that. That felt like it had that vibe.
Yeah.
Also, mental marriage.
It was there.
I'm just I mean, my eyebrows are going through the roof right now.
Yeah. I cannot guarantee veracity of anything, but Larry Sloman is a real person.
What about the U.S. representative and Jimmy Carter?
Okay, the U.S. representative, Representative Tanner. You Robert Altman fans will, of course, remember the short-lived fictional series Tanner. I'm glad that guy's still getting work as an actor.
Still getting work. So Jimmy Carter, was Dylan ever in the White House?
Yes.
So that's a real thing?
That's real.
Okay.
But that, I mean, but that's post-1975.
Slapped in, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. The date, the fuzziness of the dating, because it opens, like we said earlier, it opens with some bicentennial footage, and then them talking about taking the tours to these towns. Sam Shepard's like, these towns don't care about the bicentennial.
And, it's 1975. They already
know. Why would they care about the bicentennial? Because it was 1975, not 1976. Sam Shepard's real.
Sam Shepard is very real.
Yeah. And handsome.
You didn't know that?
I did, but just, woof. Sam Shepard. Really? Your Keanu could never. I don't know. I agree with you in that the raw footage from the tour.
Yeah, I'm very happy to see it.
It's so invigorating, man. Mm-hmm. So overpowering. Just really opened up my understanding of Dylan just in a huge way. And it was also, I thought, great to see him and Joan Baez and then the way that they were communicating with each other, kind of like verbally and non-verbally. That was really special.
There is that strange scene set in the bar where she's talking about being married and I'm still trying to parse whether that was for Ronaldo and Clara.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's weirdly lighted.
Right.
It's kind of cinematically lighted.
Right.
But the sentiments might be real. Right. What is reality?
Yeah. I don't know. What I really think is that Scorsese spent about 46 minutes working on this film and basically, like, let other people do all the dirty work. That's how it feels.
Not to me.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it feels to me like he obsessed about every...
Really?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of hours of Ronaldo and Clara to like sift through.
Oh, undoubtedly. Undoubtedly there are.
And he had to insert the filmmaker's voice in the backstage.
Yes, right. Well, yes, all fair. Although I will say this, like the narrative of the film is the narrative of the tour. It is the music. It is that to me is the most compelling footage and the most compelling through line. All these other things, they were decorative and they don't feel like they advanced anything to me, at least.
No, they're indulgences.
Yeah.
I mean, but Dylan was into the Shaggy Dog story.
Right. But it wasn't like so tricksterish that I was like, it didn't. I don't know. I'm down to be wrong about this. It just didn't feel super elevated conceptually.
I'm with you. I'm with you. I mean, I'm happy it exists for the tour footage.
We haven't talked about Hurricane. The Hurricane Carter, like the him.
The modern interview.
Yeah.
That's great.
So good. So, so good. Talk about Hurricane. Talk about that song.
1964, Dylan writes My Back Pages basically saying, I'm not going to be your topical earnest songwriter anymore. I have other things to do.
As a total sidebar, I did see a guy wearing literally a Backpage.com t-shirt the other day, and I was like, this is really bold.
Wow.
I know. Anyway, moving on.
But that's a different question entirely. Yes. Okay, Hurricane Carter was a middleweight contender who was convicted in New Jersey of a triple murder and wrote a book that Dylan read, and although he repudiated topical songs in 1964, he wrote one, Hurricane, which is a really fast-paced story that's very lucky to have a character with a name as cool as Patty Valentine. I think the Jacques Levy collaboration has something to do with how well-paced Hurricane is. This song is told almost like telegrams. I mean, it moves so fast. And he got Hurricane Carter a retrial where they convicted him again. And then 10 years later, he was freed, and the government officially called it an injustice that he had been in prison. But that was 1985. This is 1975.
We should listen to that song.
We should listen to that song, because I think that song was also an impetus for this tour. It was like, I want to get this song out. I want to get people to hear this song. I want some attention for this song.
This is about a man in jail out there you probably have heard of. We're trying to get him out of jail. Pistol shots ring out on the barroom edge. Into Petty Valentine from the outer hall. She sees a bartender in a pool of blood. Cries out, my God, they've killed them all. Here comes the story of the hurricane. The man the authorities came to blame for something that he never done. Put in a prison cell at one time. He could have been the champion of the world. Everybody's lying there, as bad as he. And another man, he fell over moving mysteriously. I did do what he says, and he throws up his hands. I was only robbing the register, you understand. I saw them leave, oh, he says, and he stops. One of us had better call on the cops. And so Patty calls the cops. And they arrive on the scene with the red lights flashing in the hot New Jersey nights.
So there's a scene in the movie where he runs up in CBS Records to go sit with Walter Yetnikoff.
This is the best scene in the movie.
This is really funny. All you rappers that think you've been running in record labels and making and inventing running up in record labels to get your records put out. No, Bob Dylan was doing that in 1975. This is what we're learning. Bob Dylan was doing all this stuff. So do you think that was a stage scene, or do you think that was him just literally showing up with cameras?
My feeling, it looks pretty guerrilla to me. It looks pretty unstaged.
Certainly that security guard didn't seem to...
It's like, you can't film you in can't here, you guy in these weird, colorful clothes.
Yeah, a great blazer. He's wearing like a floral blazer. Yeah. Like, it's a great jacket. But yeah, she was not having it.
And then they suddenly realize, my God, it's Bob Dylan, and
let
the obsequiousness ensues.
So it's funny because you see all these guys, and they're so prototypical record label guys, you know, like suits, ties.
They're sitting around a table thinking, perhaps this song will get black radio play.
Amazing. That actually was the most amazing part of that particular thing, was he's in there with the protest song about Hurricane Carter, and they're like, we're going to like, basically pitch it to black radio, or like somehow we're going to convince black radio. It was very
record company.
Extremely record company. Very, very record company. So
I don't think you could script that.
No, I agree. Certainly, or at least if it was scripted in Dylan's mind, and they just inadvertently wrote the lines as they were doing it. He must have known something like that would happen. But yeah, so that song, and at that time, was that song actually impactful, like in a radio way, in a kind of charting way?
Yeah, that song was heard on the radio. I mean, it's a 7 or 8 minute song, but it was played on the radio, and it did draw attention back to the case and did lead to the retrial. That was a protest song that did its job.
Sure. Okay, so moving forward from this time period, what did Dylan carry with him? What do you think in the late 70s into the 80s? I was sort of struck because at the end of the film, like, they're kind of treating this tour as like its own special like ecosystem, right? But then over the outgoing or later or at the end of the film or right before the credits or right after the credits, what rolls is a list of every tour date that Dylan has played subsequent to then from 1976 all the way up to 2018.
Which is pretty mind-boggling.
It was a mind-boggling number, but I was like, this is a weird choice when you're like, this tour was so special and we've made an entire film premised upon the specialness of this tour. But here's literally 3,000 other shows that he's played since then. I thought that was odd.
Well, actually, Scorsese is going to do a 2.5-hour movie about every
tour,
one of those
each
tours.
Tour. Great.
No, that's not true. That's a meta fact, okay? Sorry. That's like fictional.
Damn it, Van Dorp. Damn it.
But this tour was the one you want to see as a movie.
Did you see this tour?
No, I didn't see this tour, and I really wish I had.
Yeah.
Oh, the other thing about this tour is the Dylan sets, there are two Dylan sets on the tour. One is duets with Joan Baez, mm-hmm. and one is Dylan and the band. They're about 20 songs per night. This tour, if you went to see the Rolling Thunder Review, you were there for 3 or 4 hours.
Right.
You saw Ramblin' Jack Elliott. You saw every member of the band doing a solo turn. Every member of the stage band doing a solo song.
Apparently, Allen Ginsberg doing 5 minutes of poetry until they cut him.
Until they cut him.
They cut Allen Ginsberg and they made that man carry baggage.
Are we sure that's true?
Good point. Fair. I'm just a humble country kid. Yeah. I'm just a bumpkin who takes things that he's told at face value.
Yeah, I mean, do we know if that was... I mean, it's vintage footage, but maybe they did that for Ronaldo and Clara. I do not know.
Good point.
But anyway, it went on for 4 hours. Joan Baez did a solo set. Your local guest did a solo set.
Mm-hmm.
You were in, Canada, right. Got Gordon Lightfoot, Joni Mitchell. I mean, it went on and on. And then at the end, there's this totally incendiary Dylan and Scarlett Rivera tearing up the place.
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody comes on for this, version of This Land Is Your Land. To me, I don't know about you, but it sounds like an old-time radio show finale.
Mm.
It's, bouncy, it's country. Everybody gets a verse, singers and non-singers alike. Joni Mitchell has her own verse, and she has coast-to-coast Canadian geography, which is pretty cool.
True.
It's sort of backing off the intensity of the Dylan songs to say, oh, this was just a vaudeville show coming through town. Here's our big finale, Thanks, folks. I mean, it really feels like the sign-off from the King Biscuit Flower Hour or a WSM, live country show.
Right.
Even then, he was distancing you from him. He was saying, this is show business. This is vaudeville. At the same time, you have these songs that feel like you're going through, epic transformations. It was a multi-level tour.
Let's go out with the slippery trickster Bob Dylan and the crew singing This Land Is Your Land.
Thank you. That's a Woody Guthrie song we're going to close with now. We'll see you next time.
Here we are on the New York Island. That's our show. Thank you to John Pareles for continuing to educate me. I appreciate you. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. If you are Martin Scorsese or Bob Dylan.
Please explain your intentions.
Yeah,
that's all we ask.
Or if you are privy to their inner mental workings, email me at podcast@nytimes.com. If you are interested in metafiction or autofiction as well, I would be curious to know what you think about the gambits used in this film. And subscribe to podcasts anywhere that your audio is a thing that you subscribe to, be it Stitcher or Google Play, or I guess I used to say iTunes, but I guess not iTunes anymore because iTunes is being killed, which I would totally do a whole other episode on, except we just did the AirPods episode. Okay, Pedro says it's Apple Podcasts, so I guess download that app and download and subscribe to podcasts. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, and we will be back, I would say next week, but in truth, it's going to be in just a few days.